You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Daniels. Regular listeners of our podcast might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On Tuesday, October 13, 2009, Bill Bergen, an expert on Union Major General Horatio Wright, delivered a presentation on General Wright and the Battle of Cedar Creek, Virginia. Fought on October 19, 1864, Cedar Creek was the last major action in the Shenandoah Valley. This is the seventh and final part of this series for 2009. Bill Bergen.
Thank you, Rick. I want to second Rick's endorsement of this trip coming up, even what kind of weather. I think that the Battle of Cedar Creek reenactment is one of the most evocative things that I have ever seen in Civil War lore. And it's really nice because it's not July in Virginia and unbearably hot. As for the weather report, when you have a title like Assistant Dean for Administrative Services, you tend to accumulate a lot of duties, and among mine is the law school's official weatherman. I haven't been checking, but you know, one definition of a weather report is horoscope with numbers. So I'm going to talk today about the Battle of Cedar Creek, which was one of the most dramatic and important victories for the Union. Ended effectively the fighting in the Shenandoah Valley. A meandering stream known as Cedar Creek, a looming mountain the Indians named Masnutten, a quiet plantation named Bell Grove overlooking the turnpike, a column found in a field near Middleton, Virginia, reenactors who gather each October on the fields where their forefathers fought, monuments in half-hidden places to brave men who fought and died, a forgotten statue along Embassy Row in Washington, D.C., a battlefield threatened by development, and finally, a grave in Arlington Cemetery that everyone has seen without knowing what you saw. These scenes are among the enduring reminders of the Battle of Cedar Creek. These traces of the past remind us of the Civil War's final pitched battle in the fought over Shenandoah Valley. The victory helped secure U.S. President Lincoln's reelection, even as it doomed the Confederacy hopes for another miraculous victory in the valley. We begin with that grave in Arlington Cemetery. Most, if not all of you, have seen it on the ridge above the three Kennedy brothers' gravesites, and you see the eternal flame there in the foreground. The prominent monument marks the grave of a forgotten Union general who figures prominently in the story of Cedar Creek. It is adorned only by a bas-relief portrait depicting a general even Civil War enthusiasts would have a hard time identifying. To find out who the grave marks, visitors must brush aside the overgrown shrubbery and read the plaque on its back. Only then does one learn that there lies Major General Horatio Gouverneur Wright, and that veterans of the Sixth Corps erected the monument to honor their former commander. There is a second monument opposite Wright's grave that also reminds us of the Battle of Cedar Creek. On the other side of Arlington House's portico is a monument marking the resting place of Philip Sheridan, Wright's commander during the final phase of the 1864 Valley Campaign. Unlike Wright's anonymous monument, one can easily read the word Sheridan in metal letters embedded in the stone. A bronze flag-draped medallion exhibits Sheridan's all-too-familiar likenesses. That right remains rest near Sheridan suggests his close association with the hero of Cedar Creek. While heading the Department of the Ohio, Wright, recognizing Sheridan's worth, co-signed a September 12, 1862 telegram to the War Department that prompted the award to Sheridan of his first star. "We have no good generals here and are badly in want of them," Wright wired. "Sheridan is worth his weight in gold. Will you not try and have him made a brigadier at once? That will put us in good shape." Later, Wright served loyally under his former subordinate in the 1864 Valley Campaign, at the Battle of Sailor's Creek, and in post-war Texas. Both men would reach the top of their army branches, Wright retiring as chief of engineers the same year that Sheridan became commanding general of the army. But if Wright's monument ranks with Sheridan, his fame does not. A book about the Civil War has been published every day since the end of the conflict. Yet Wright did not receive any detailed consideration by historians until 3 years ago. This lack of attention is puzzling given the breadth of Wright's war experience. He fought the war as an engineer, as a War Department insider, as a recruiting officer, as a commander in amphibious operations in the Deep South, as a major department head in the Midwest, and as a senior infantry commander through the bloody final 2 years of the Army of the Potomac's existence. He was captured once, and while serving as major general, twice wounded. Most striking, few know how, under the most confusing and difficult of circumstances, Wright's personal heroism and sound decisions enabled Phil Sheridan to lead U.S. forces to their signal victory at the Battle of Cedar Creek. Well, I'm trying to back up here. There we go. Horatio Wright's journey to that memorable day begins with his birth in 1820 to a prominent family in the port of Clinton, Connecticut. Wright's birthplace still stands, and one can rent the Horatio Wright room in what is today a bed and breakfast. Wright entered the U.S. Military Academy in 1837 and graduated 4 years later, ranking second in his class. On August 11, 1842, Wright married Louisa Bradford of Culpeper, Virginia. Louisa's mother was a member of the Slaughter family, a clan that included several civic and military leaders in the Virginia Piedmont. Louisa grew up in a household whose wealth included several dozen slaves. In his years at the academy as a leading student, later as an instructor, Wright became acquainted with dozens of those who would lead forces on both sides of the Civil War. Yet no firsthand recollection has been found. This pattern of achieving prominence and yet escaping notice would persist throughout his life. Unlike most of his West Point classmates, Wright saw no action in the Mexican War and spent his entire pre-war years in engineering and staff duties. The eve of the Civil War found then-Captain Wright in his 6 years the principal assistant to the Chief of Engineers in Washington, D.C. 6 days after Fort Sumter fell, Wright suddenly found himself in combat for the first time. Ordered to assume command of a small army force in a seaborne expedition to Norfolk's Navy Yard, Wright's mission was to save the key base from falling into the Confederacy's hands, or, barring that, to destroy the yard to prevent anything useful from falling into the Confederacy's control. That the effort was only partly successful, most notably the damage done to USS Merrimack was not enough to prevent it from becoming the ironclad CSS Virginia. Moreover, Wright was captured by militia, though he was quickly exchanged. Later in 1861, Wright played a role in seizing the Arlington Heights, where his monument now stands, and fought in the First Battle of Bull Run. On September 14th, Wright was appointed Brigadier General of Volunteers, and the next day assumed command of a brigade of Connecticut regiments then forming in Washington, D.C. For the first time in nearly a quarter of a century in uniform, Wright directly commanded troops. In late October 1861, Wright's brigade sailed as part of an amphibious force that seized Port Royal, South Carolina. His command participated in several actions along the coast over the next several months. In August 1862, Wright was ordered west to head a reorganized and expanded Department of the Ohio. His new command included the states of Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, and part of Kentucky. Wright took command at a perilous time. Two armies had invaded Kentucky and by early September threatened Cincinnati and Louisville, creating an atmosphere bordering on hysteria. Wright worked to check the rebels' advance by fortifying Cincinnati and moving troops to the most threatened points. Wright also cooperated with his classmate, Major General Don Carlos Buell, forwarding troops to his Army of Tennessee that played a key role in the victory at the Battle of Perrysburg. The invasions having been turned back, Wright turned to other duties, but as it turned out, his tenure was cut short. In March 1863, Wright's permanent promotion to Major General was blocked by the Senate, a majority of whom apparently considered him insufficiently aggressive. Wright understandably interpreted this as a lack of confidence in his abilities and successfully requested to be relieved as departmental commander. In May, Wright was reassigned to command a division in the Army of the Potomac's Sixth Corps. He reported to Corps Commander Major General John Sedgwick less than 2 weeks after the end of the Chancellorsville campaign. Wright's division was engaged lightly at Gettysburg, and it was not until the next spring offensive that Wright directed his troops in a pitched battle. In May 5th and 6th, 1864, Battle of the Wilderness, Wright accomplished little more than other generals who attempted to maneuver troops through the heavily wooded terrain. During the May 6th Confederate flank attack, Wright kept his division from panicking and helped contain damage done to the Union line. In the early evening of May 7th, the Army of the Potomac pulled out of its line at Wilderness to begin a race with the Confederate Army to reach the strategic crossroads of Spotsylvania Courthouse. After the initial attacks on Confederate positions failed, both sides began entrenching. The following day, May 9th, a rebel sharpshooter killed Sedgwick near the front lines. Wright took command in his friend's place. With the promotion came Senate confirmation of his rank as Major General, and Wright led the Sixth Corps for the remainder of the war. Wright and the Sixth Corps would not, as it turned out, spend the summer and fall in Petersburg. As Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee slugged their way over the Virginia Tidewater in what became known as the Overland Campaign, important actions were taking place in the Shenandoah Valley, the Confederacy's breadbasket. Grant's coordinated spring offensive included an advance by a small federal army up the Shenandoah Valley to threaten Confederate communications and deprive Lee of supplies from that fertile region. That federal force, ineptly commanded by Major General Franz Sigel, headed south on the same day Grant crossed the Rapidan River en route to the Wilderness. Defeated by Confederate Army at the May 15th Battle of New Market, Sigel retreated back down the valley. Grant remained determined to seize the valley, however, and by early June, a new Union advance had brushed aside a small Confederate force at the Battle of Piedmont and had reached Staunton. Now commanded by Major General David Hunter, the Federal forces marched on to Lexington and turned towards the southeast and Lynchburg, a strategic rail center. Lee countered this threat by dispatching newly promoted Lieutenant General Jubal Early and his Second Corps to Lynchburg. Early's timely arrival not only blocked Hunter, but also sent him retreating west into the mountains. With the Shenandoah Valley now clear of Yankees, Early's veterans marched down the familiar hard road of the Valley Turnpike, past the fields of their triumphs during Stonewall Jackson's 1862 Valley Campaign. Grant did not learn that Early's corps had left the Petersburg front until the Confederate force had crossed the Potomac in early July. With the rebel force threatening Washington and Baltimore, Grant responded by sending the Sixth Corps north. Wright and two of his divisions landed in Washington just in time to beat back Early's probe at Fort Stevens on July 11th and 12th. Much of official Washington turned out to cheer the troops as they marched to the front lines located north and west of the city. Lincoln cabinet members, Mrs. Lincoln, Wright's wife, and members of Congress followed them, hoping to see a little of the war. Arriving late on July 11th, Wright quickly sized up the Confederate probes as just that. The following day, he ordered a brigade to push the Confederate lines back. Other than his official reports and messages, Wright left few accounts of his action during the war. The most complete of these outlined his role in nearly getting President Lincoln killed during the fighting at Fort Stevens. In an 1870 letter, Wright recalled that he had, quote, thoughtlessly invited Lincoln to watch his troops advance. A moment later, he said, I would have given much to have recalled my words. Lincoln took his place on the parapet, where he parried Wright's initial entreaties to get down, even after an officer standing near him was wounded. The general opined that Lincoln retired after several anxious minutes only, and this is a wonderful 19th century understatement, in deference to my earnestly expressed wishes. Well into the 20th century, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who in 1864 was a captain on Wright's staff, said that he did not recognize the president and had shouted, "Get down, you damn fool!" Though that incident cannot be discounted entirely, the weight of the evidence from other recollections suggests that Wright's account remains the more accurate description, and that Holmes' wonderful story is just that. Like many other Civil War veterans who told too good to be true stories, Holmes waited until nearly everyone who could contradict him was dead. After withdrawing from the Washington area, Early parried several efforts to catch his army and dealt a defeat to a detachment of U.S. forces at the Second Battle of Kernstown. Afterwards, Early again crossed the Potomac and sent cavalry into Pennsylvania, where they burned the town of Chambersburg on July 30th. The Sixth Corps, which had been set to embark again for Petersburg, marched instead to Washington. Grant, having lost patience with Union failure in the valley, Grant, having lost patience with Union failure in the valley, sent his trusted subordinate, Cavalry Chief Phil Sheridan, to command the combined U.S. forces. Wright's Sixth Corps, along with two of the Army of the Potomac's cavalry divisions, formed the backbone of Sheridan's new Army of the Shenandoah. Other infantry units included Valley veterans George Crook's force, now designated the Eighth Corps, and the two divisions of the 19th Corps, commanded by Major General William Emory. Throughout August, the two opposing armies maneuvered in the lower valley, each trying to catch the other at a disadvantage. Not until September 19th did Sheridan finally commit to engage the enemy on a field that would become known as a Pekin, or Third Winchester. Sheridan planned for a rapid advance against the segment of Early's army, hoping to defeat it before the Confederates could concentrate their forces. Sheridan's advance was slowed first by fording the Pekin, and then by the steep grade and wet surface of the road. As a result of that delay, Sheridan failed to attack before Early's reinforcements arrived. In numbers and in casualties, in the percentage of those engaged, Third Winchester was the bloodiest battle ever fought in the Shenandoah. Despite being driven back in the early part of the action, Sheridan kept up the pressure and finally turned the Confederate army's flank and swept the Confederates from the field. Early reformed his army just south of the town of Strasburg along a formidable series of bluffs known collectively as Fisher's Hill. On September 1, Crook's 8th Corps attacked the Confederate flank, and Wright followed up with an assault that contributed to flushing the rebels out of their lines. One veteran noted Wright's courage, writing home that the general took an active role in encouraging the men and directing movements of the artillery. The result was a second complete rout of the rebels in 3 days. Pursuing Early up the valley, Sheridan's army undertook the systematic destruction of crops, barns, mills, and the confiscation of livestock in the region between Stanton and Strasbourg, a period that became known as the Burning. On their return, the Army of the Potomac stopped along the quiet banks of Cedar Creek, just south of the hamlet of Middletown. While camped there, Sheridan decided to travel to Washington to resolve questions raised by headquarters about future operations. As next ranking officer, Wright assumed temporary command of the Army of the Shenandoah. Sheridan expected to be absent only briefly, and no one anticipated the Army would establish a base at Cedar Creek. The Army had paused there in August, but Sheridan, considering the position indefensible, had withdrawn to the north. Believing the twice defeated and twice routed Confederates incapable of offensive action, Sheridan posted his army with an eye more for the troops' comfort than for defense. Farther south and east, Crook's 8th Corps camped on the high ground overlooking the Creek Valley, positioned mostly to contest a movement up the valley turnpike to their right. Emory's divisions pitched their tent on the west side of the pike and slightly to the north of Crook's position. Farther west and north, Wright's own 6th Corps camped in the open fields. The rolling ground did not lend itself to defense, and Sheridan further weakened his army by scattering it over 5 miles along 6 separate ridges. The Federal Army, now expecting to stay put for a few days, began to entrench. On both October 17th and 18th, Wright, acting in Sheridan's stead, ordered the army to be roused at 4 a.m. and ready for action by sunrise. But on October 19th, Wright decided against waking his entire force in the pre-dawn hours. On the morning of the Battle of Cedar Creek, most of the Army of the Shenandoah slept in. Jubal Early's surprise attack ranks among the greatest feats of the war. From their vantage point on Three Tops Mountain, the spur of Massanutten, Early's lieutenants, General John Gordon and topographical engineer Jed Hutchiss among them, devised a complex attack plan involving several columns and intricate timing. Now, if you take a look at this map here, you'll see that on the far right bottom or center right bottom, the attack would be led by Gordon, who would sneak across, use some obscure trails, sneak across the mostly unguarded Cedar Creek, and attack Crook's force in the in flank. And meanwhile, Kershaw would take a somewhat more direct route, and he would cross the creek at a different point, at a different ford, and then continue on to hit Crook pretty much in front. And then once Crook began to retreat, they would be hit by Wharton's column, which would come straight up the Valley Turnpike and bring with them most of the artillery. That his twice routed, underfed, and undersupplied army achieved all of its initial objectives remains a signal accomplishment. That their puny numbers, about 15,000 men versus the Union's 31,000, were able to drive the U.S. forces back remains one of the great feats of the war. On the Union side, that such a successful surprise assault was launched constitutes the blackest mark on Wright's war record. At the first sound of battle, Wright galloped towards the sound of the guns to begin 5 hours commanding an army staggered by one flanking move after another. The nature of Wright's adversary was literally and figuratively shrouded in fog. He did not know whether Early had been substantially reinforced, and in the early hours, the battle mist obscured the direction and strength of the Confederate attack. Wright was ubiquitous that chilly morning, directing troop placements, conferring with other officers, and trying to understand what the Confederates were up to. Most remarkable was his action some 30 minutes after the assault began. Looking to buy time for other troops to form on a hill further back, Wright met Colonel Thomas Wilds at the head of an 8th Corps brigade near the Valley Turnpike. Though Wilds' brigade had fought a determined delay in action in the face of overwhelming numbers, Wright ordered it to return to the fray. By launching this delaying attack, Wright hoped that he would stop the route along the line and give time for a line to be formed west and north of Wilds' position. Rallying two of his regiments, Wiles turned around and headed back into the fight and quickly found that Wright was leading the charge. Wright, Wiles would write later, displayed great personal courage, but gallant as he was and the men who followed him were, they were obliged to give way before the awful fire they met at the edge of the woods. Wild's account bears some emphasis. Wright risked his life by leading a forlorn hope of an attack. He never led an attack in the dozen of other times Wright had been under fire, though he had earned a reputation for being always close to the action. Moreover, at some point in this effort, he sustained a wound to the chin and might have been captured if it were not for General Crook and an aide who bravely intervened to help the dazed Wright off the field. The Confederate attack was designed not only to surprise the Federal Army, but to defeat it piecemeal. In this, Sheridan's faulty dispositions, not Wright's failure to adequately picket the fords along Cedar Creek, hurt the Union Army badly. While the 8th Corps had been surprised, both the 19th and 6th Corps had adequate time to form before coming under attack, but they were hindered by the nature of the ground, the fog, and for at least part of the morning, the sun. Moreover, the Confederate attackers benefited most from the uneven ground and from the knowledge they had gained of the Union dispositions. By repeated flanking movements, Early's army forced the 19th Corps and then the 6th Corps, 1st and 3rd Divisions, to quit the field. Wright then faced a crucial choice. He could fully commit his remaining unbloodied division, or he could begin to disengage and draw off to the north and west to buy time to rally. Wright chose to refuse battle, ordering a general withdrawal with a view towards circling back towards the vital Valley Turnpike. He later explained that a change of front was necessary, and this must be made to a position which would place our force between the enemy and our base. With this goal in mind, he summoned the cavalry divisions from their positions on the Army's far right. These two decisions, to disengage the infantry and to reinforce his left by shifting the cavalry to hold the pike, proved crucial to the ultimate Union victory. Jubal Early's forces did not immediately follow Wright's withdrawing army. Despite the federal rout, Early's army was nearly as disorganized in victory as his opponent was in defeat. Moreover, the tired, hungry, and ill-clothed rebels found abandoned Union camps too much of a temptation to resist. Many soldiers succumbed and fell out of the ranks. Once Wright had reformed the army north of Middletown, he ordered preparations for a counterattack to begin in early afternoon. These preparations were undertaken with some trepidation, as many soldiers believed that it would not be successful. However, Sheridan's dramatic arrival around 10:30 a.m. made all believe that victory could and would happen. His return from Washington had taken longer than planned, and Sheridan had spent the night in Winchester. Discomforted by the sound of battle early in October 19th, Sheridan elected to ride to Cedar Creek and once there to rally the army. One veteran's reaction to Sheridan's dramatic return was typical of that of the entire army. The magnetism of his fiery energy electrified the army with a kindred spirit, and they fought with just that desperate valor that was needed to turn the tide of affairs in our favor. After carefully sorting through the various intelligence and reviewing the ground, Sheridan galloped along the entire federal line to whip up enthusiasm among his men. He then launched a counterattack that swept the rebel army from the field in the late afternoon. His attack recovered all lost ground, recaptured all artillery, and took thousands of Confederate prisoners. During the attack, Wright, still bleeding from his painful wound, directed the 6th Corps, took an active part in coordinating that afternoon, twice intervening in person with his 3rd Division to ensure they kept up with the advance. The resounding decisive defeat of the Confederate Army in the valley, where it continually embarrassed Federal forces, and the seeming miraculous rally from the morning reversals helped ensure Lincoln's reelection. The victory prompted an unusual outpouring of prose and poetry. No event in that battle, and perhaps none in the entire war, thrilled Northerners as much as Sheridan's dramatic return to his army and the rally that ensued. Sheridan's feat became the subject of an enormously popular poem written by then prominent poet Thomas Buchanan Reed. from its first public reading on October 31, 1864, Sheridan's Ride quickly caught the public's imagination and would be featured for generations to come at veteran reunions, patriotic exercises of all kinds, and in classrooms across the northern states. Many in the Sixth Corps believed that they and their commander had not received credit for what they accomplished, and they blamed the poem. A veteran of the Sixth Corps' 1st Division, Wright's old outfit, remembered that his conduct was such to endear him more than ever to the men of his command. He exposed himself very much and came near being captured. He prepared the way by which the genius of Sheridan was enabled to make victory change sides. The newspaper accounts follows the outlines of Reed's poem. In the poet's eyes, the army was retreating before Sheridan arrived, and through the force of his character, turned things around. If early newspaper stories cited Wright at all, they mentioned his being wounded. A long account in the New York Herald referred to Wright's wound and his being near the front lines during the whole day, but nothing else. While no newspaper blamed Wright for the morning reverses, none gave him credit for steadying the army before Sheridan arrived. The 1864 Valley Campaign finally finished. Wright and the Sixth Corps returned to Petersburg and the trenches in December 1864. By early 1865, as the Army of Potomac prepared for its final campaign, Wright adopted much of Ulysses S. Grant's steely determination to end the war quickly. On April 2nd, Wright's preparation paid off when in a well-planned and executed attack, the Sixth Corps broke through Lee's formidable, albeit undermanned, fortifications. Wright's success broke the stalemate and hurried Lee's abandonment of Petersburg. The victory did not come without considerable cost, as the Sixth Corps lost more than 1,100 men. During the pursuit to Appomattox, Sheridan and Wright cooperated for a final time at the April 6th Battle of Sailor's Creek, where their commands trapped nearly a third of Lee's army. Sheridan's cavalry that morning delayed forces commanded by Generals Richard H. Anderson and Richard H. Ewell long enough for the Sixth Corps to catch up. After some spirited combat, including a Confederate counterattack, Wright's veterans overwhelmed Early's force. Nearly 3,400 Confederates surrendered, among them Ewell and Custis Lee, the general's son, and 4 other generals. Wright was not present during the surrender discussions between Lee and Grant on April 9th, but the Sixth Corps was close enough to see the Confederate commander leave the McLean house. Wright called his men to attention as Lee rode to tell his men they were surrendered. In the celebrations that followed the surrender, Wright was almost dragged from his horse in the mad rejoicing. After the Sixth Corps disbanded, Wright became commander of the Provisional Corps that constituted the remnant of the Army of the Potomac. In July 1865, he was appointed commander of the Department of Texas, reporting again to Phil Sheridan, now the district commander. After about a year, Wright showed himself to be too reasonable for Sheridan's taste in his dealing with the state's elected governor, and the district head arranged to have his associate replaced, and Wright happily returned to his peacetime rank of lieutenant colonel of engineers. He spent the next 18 years working on dozens of public works projects, the Brooklyn Bridge, and the Washington Monument's completion, the most famous of these. At a time when many of his fellow officers were publishing their accounts of the war, Wright's only publication was as a co-author of Report on the Fabrication of Iron for Defensive Purposes and Its Use in Modern Fortifications, Especially in Works of Coast Defense, a treatise on his core specialty in military engineering. Wright retired in 1884 after 5 years as Brigadier General and Chief of Engineers. Wright lived quietly in retirement in Washington with summers in Clinton, Connecticut. Wright died at the age of 79 in Washington on July 2, 1899. The then Chief of Engineers, Brigadier General John M. Wilson, selected Wright's burial site and in a florid general order paid tribute to his predecessor as peerless, accomplished, knightly soldier, of commanding presence, brave and strong to act, equally at home on the field or in the council chamber, the memory of our hero will be held in reverence by his fellow countrymen. Wilson's prediction did not come true. as Wright's renown has never matched the prominence of his Arlington Cemetery monument. By not writing memoirs or articles, and by not leaving papers to any institution, he contributed to his own obscurity. Few with whom he served wrote anything substantive about Wright, and his generalship has not undergone scholarly examination until recently. During the 1864 Valley Campaign, Wright compiled a solid record. His Sixth Corps seized the key ground that made possible the victory at Fisher's Hills, but most of the attention in that under-examined battle has gone to Crook for the turning movement and to Sheridan for urging the attack from the front lines. At Cedar Creek, the routing of two-thirds of the army he commanded embarrassed Wright to the point that his report on the battle borders on incoherence. Nevertheless, the numerous battle accounts of Wright's frontline visibility, courtesy, and calm demeanor attest to his effect on steadying men rocked by probably the war's finest surprise attack. Most important, the decisions he made in withdrawing from contact with the Confederates and transferring the cavalry to the army's left set up Sheridan's counterattack. After the war, Sheridan would receive all the accolades for the surprising and electrifying comeback in the day, and Wright would be cast as an inept leader who had invited disaster, wrote Theodore Marr, the foremost modern historian of the battle. This simply is not true. Without Wright's tactical judgment in the morning fight, the potential for Sheridan's great victory in the afternoon would not have been there. In contrast to his earlier mixed record, Wright performed laudably during the 1865 Appomattox campaign. He clearly appreciated the need for speed and determination and exercised both. In breaking the Confederate lines on April 2nd and in seizing the opportunities presented at Sailor's Creek, Wright seemed almost a different general from the sometimes tentative officers seen earlier in the war. Perhaps Wright, always a thoughtful officer, had decided during the winter of 1864 and 65 to reflect on his own performance and decide to emulate the aggressive tactics Sheridan employed with success in the Valley Campaign. He may have concluded that careful but determined use of superior numbers and materiel would bring victory. Besides Sixth Corps veterans and his fellow engineers, few noted the passing of Horatio Wright. His obscurity stems from several factors beyond his own reticence. Arriving in mid-1863, he was a latecomer to the Army of the Potomac, and he accomplished nothing memorable during the Gettysburg Campaign, that battle that boosted the memory of so many peers. Joshua Chambers' role in that battle, for example, and his eloquent memoirs had led to several books and countless articles, while Wright, a more consequential Army of the Potomac figure, remains forgotten. The nature of his victories also figures in Wright's obscurities. His successes were either minor or overshadowed by larger events. In this latter category, news of breaking through the Confederate lines on April 2, 1865, was obscured by the spectacular victory at Five Forks on March 34th and the fall of Petersburg and Richmond on April 3rd. Moreover, the victory at Sailor's Creek was eclipsed by the surrender 2 days later at Appomattox. At Cedar Creek, there seems to be no room in the public imagination for only one hero, and Philip Sheridan's ride to victory trumps Wright's considerable feats that day. Sheridan deserves the credit and the accolades. As one scholar put it, the ride remains by far the best example how a charismatic officer could infuse spirit into the soldiers on the battlefield. Being an unreflective and ungenerous man, he probably never thought long about how Wright's efforts to retrieve the day had made his victory possible. Wright's accomplishments at Cedar Creek appear all the more remarkable in that he made the crucial decisions with a confidence and a certainty that belied his temporary status as Army commander, the unknown and unseen size of the forces he confronted, and, of course, his own wound. It remains nevertheless remarkable that Wright could be so thoroughly forgotten. A final cause of that obscurity lies in the character of the man. Late in life, Wright expressed distaste to what he called the disease of loving newspaper fame. As a gentleman and as a soldier, Wright could not and would not call attention to himself and that included promoting accomplishments during and after the war. These qualities are epitomized in his leading Colonel Wild's brigade back into the fog and into the fray at Cedar Creek. Many who were there wrote about seeing Wright bleeding. Only Colonel Wilds recorded how it happened, and did so in an obscure book published many years later. By 1864, Army commanders did not lead troops into battle, but Wright's supreme sense of duty that day moved into the most courageous, even foolhardy of acts. Then characteristically, he never called attention to it. As a result, Wright's heroism attracted no notice. And so Wright remains forgotten, his solitary reminder, a monument on Arlington Heights erected by the Sixth Corps veterans who knew what they and their commander had achieved. Horatio Wright's grave lies on the ridge he helped seize, facing the Washington Monument he helped build, seen by millions, but noticed by only a few. Welcome to that select group. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.